It's On Second Thought. I'm Tony Harris. On this day in 1951, Willie McGee, a black man, was executed in Laurel, Mississippi, convicted of raping a white woman. He claimed the sex was consensual. His trial and execution drew national attention. William Faulkner and Albert Einstein came to his defense, asking for clemency. McGee's granddaughter teamed with Peabody Award-winning producer Joe Richman on his podcast, Radio Diaries. Joe is in Atlanta today for the Radiotopia Live East Coast Tour, but before he hits the stage tonight and before another dress rehearsal later this afternoon, Joe has joined me here in studio. Joe, good to have you on the program.
Oh, thanks for having me. It's good to be here.
How did you first reported on this how many years ago now?
This was back for the, wow, it's a while now because it was for the anniversary. And, you know, this story came to us sort of by accident. We do, at Radio Diaries, we do kind of a mix of diaries where we give people tape recorders and also a lot of historical documentaries. And we were doing some research in Mississippi for some archival materials and tape. And the archivist there just said, you've got to hear this. And what he played was this recording of what was essentially a public execution.
Yeah.
People gathered in the courthouse where the execution was taking place inside. And just this, the story of how this tape survived is fascinating. But we heard that recording and knew that that was this kind of forgotten chapter of history. And then we went looking for who could be the characters to tell it. And we found Bridget McGee, William McGee's granddaughter, who just happened to be launching her own kind of detective
work. Oh, really?
Work. Yeah.
Really? So that's interesting, Joe, because you could have told this in so many different ways, right? You could have narrated this, right? It could have been a reporter-driven piece, but you found Bridget McGee Robinson. And tell me about the process of making the decision. You could have featured her in it. She didn't have to be the first person to count through it.
Yeah. I mean, for me, this was actually, this story was like the holy grail of what we want to do and the kind of work that we do. Is combining the kind of personal first-person diaries that we do along with an important historical documentary. So it was just turning her into the reporter. And, you know, it was an interesting process. Bridget and I, she hadn't been back to Mississippi since she was a little girl. And we spent a lot of time there, you know, just, looking for his grave, going to visit this program's called William McGee and the Traveling Electric Chair, because Mississippi at the time had a traveling electric chair that went from courthouse to courthouse. So we went and found the electric chair, which bizarrely is in this police academy surrounded by like softball trophies.
It's right.
Like, it's very, very strange.
The traveling electric chair.
Yeah.
Oh my goodness.
So we interviewed everyone we could in Laurel, Mississippi, black and white. And, you know, there's this real division there still today of what people think based on race, what happened in this story based on race. So partly it was just working with her to turn her into a reporter, you know?
Yes, yes.
Which is really, and by the end, she was amazing. Right. Just in the sense of being able to not bring what she thought, but, you know, maintain curiosity and interview people in a really beautiful way.
And part of what is amazing about her is when you hear the story, so much of it just captures you. But I want to play a clip. This is her describing how she stumbled upon a picture of a man, right, as she's with her mom, that she didn't recognize. And this is from your podcast.
I remember us about 12 or 13 years old. I was with my mom. We were cleaning out her room. She was under her mattress, and there was these newspaper articles inside a plastic bag. And there was a photograph. And so I said, who's this man? And she said, that's your grandfather. And I asked her, well, what happened to him? But she snatched it from me and told me to put it back.
So eventually, Joe, Bridget's mom told her, I guess this was on her deathbed, right, to find out what happened to her grandfather. But her mom, in many ways, maybe I should ask it as a question, did her mom know what happened? But she was, it's seemingly, asking her to find out something more.
Yeah. I mean, the family, when he was executed, the family left Mississippi. They moved to Las Vegas, where Bridget grew up. And they never talked about it. They never talked about it again. It was a family secret. And so Bridget found these newspaper clippings and always wondered. And yeah, it was on her mother's deathbed where she said, you know, Bridget had been curious and knew that the family didn't want this discussed. And her mother basically gave her permission, or even, I suppose, instruction to say, go. And we had the good fortune of hooking up with Bridget soon after that, where she had her own kind of burning curiosity. And we had kind of the journalistic, you know, kind of research resources to team up with her and really try to find, you know, it really, ultimately, it's an unanswerable question, what really happened.
Right.
There's no way to really know. So the whole story requires that spirit of unknowability, even though Bridget in her heart feels like what she knows. But it's still, it was a search to figure out what we can know in a situation like that.
What was the experience of going to Mississippi like for Bridget? Because I think for a lot of African-Americans, if you can feel Mississippi from essentially the moment you cross into the state, you feel that history, that weight.
Yeah. That is it's a really interesting question, because I didn't understand that till I met her there. You know, she had a lot of, feelings about going back there. And she was really nervous. She told me how nervous she was. She brought her husband along, which at first I was worried about. It's like, he's going to be tagging along on this whole research trip, but he ended up being amazing.
Yeah.
And anyway, when I met her, because we had been talking on the phone, but I hadn't met her yet. We met in Mississippi. She was wearing a McGee family reunion T-shirt, which I just thought was so badass. You know, she had all this fear, and yet she was like, this is my name, and I'm plunging in. But she kind of took it both ways.
Yeah, that's so interesting to me, because I've done some reporting in Mississippi, and for me, the minute you cross into that state, you just feel it. I wonder if we can go back to the actual case, 1945, Willie McGee's arrested for the rape of a white woman. Fair to say, Joe, there weren't many rape prosecutions in Mississippi in those days where the victim was a black woman and the suspect was a white man. Fair to say that?
I think it's probably fair to say.
How did prosecutors link McGee to this crime?
Well, it was the woman, it was her charge.
It was her charge.
And there are a lot of stories. So the basic issue was, if you're on the black side of the tracks, you believe probably that it was a consensual relationship. And if you're on the white side, you believe that that just didn't exist or couldn't happen. That's what Bridget found as we were doing interviews.
But there was no Atticus Finch defending Willie McGee.
There was so no Atticus Finch. Although at the end, Bella Abzug and some other lawyers from New York came down, which created its own problems, of course. You know, sort of, white women, New York Jewish lawyers coming down. And so there was this feeling of the outside world coming in to Laurel, Mississippi, and that created its own tensions. But no, the first trial, I think, lasted 7 seconds or something like that. So there were three trials ultimately, and it went on for a while. You mentioned Atticus Finch. It really was in many ways a real life To Kill a Mockingbird.
Did McGee ever claim in court? I know he didn't testify, but did he ever claim through his attorneys in court that the relationship was consensual?
He never did. Isn't that interesting?
How do you explain that? Yeah. That's so odd.
Was it something about the time? I think the idea was at that time that would have been worse to claim that.
What did you come to?
And of course, there were a lot of, again, speaking of To Kill a Mockingbird, there were a lot of, concern that, him in prison, that he would be taken out of prison and lynched or something like that.
So. Yeah. His execution was a public spectacle. And take a moment here and describe the night he was killed.
So there were about 1,000 people gathered in the courthouse in Laurel, Mississippi. And as I said, Mississippi at that time had what was called the traveling electric chair that went from courthouse to courthouse. The idea was, I think it was probably a sort of a spectacle deterrent sort of effect. It also had the effect of bringing executions to different communities. So people gathered for this event. It happened inside the courthouse, so the public didn't witness the actual execution, but they were there on the grounds. And to me, I mean, I'm an archival tape geek. I love those kind of dusty recordings. And the fact that this recording survived is really a miracle, because it was the only reason it survived. There's actually very little archival tape from this period. Things just didn't get saved. But this guy, Jim Leeson, who was a teenager at the time, had gotten a new reel-to-reel tape recorder and knew that this was going to be broadcast on the radio. He was in a nearby town. And he held his microphone up to the radio and recorded it. And then he kept it for like 5 decades until he donated it to the archive where we found it. So it's just this like stroke of luck that this thing was even saved.
You want to hear a bit of it?
Let's hear it. It's you should probably warn people that it's, as you might expect, it's a little bit disturbing.
Ladies and gentlemen, we just assume that that last surge was the final few thousand volts of electricity that meant the end of Willie McGee.
Okay, Granville, thank you very much. Certainly WAML and WFOR intended no sensationalism in this. It was simply that it was a news story, and we wanted to cover it as best we possibly could.
Have you given any thought, Joe, to this question? What do you suspect the impact would be of broadcasting state-sanctioned executions today?
Yeah, I've given that a lot of thought. I'll speak with half my brain as a journalist and the other half just my own sort of personal opinions. They actually, I think on this issue, they come together because I just feel like information is power. And I think one of the reasons we feel in our society that the way that we allow executions to happen is because they are so antiseptic and removed. And I think if we did see more about them, if we were able to witness things, I think that we would do it more clear-eyed, and I think that maybe we'd feel differently about the death penalty. So that's partly my personal opinion and partly how I feel about journalism in general.
McGee's granddaughter was able to track down the son of the district attorney in the case. Who was the district attorney?
John Schwarzenegger was the son, and I'm forgetting his father's name, but his father was the prosecutor who sent Bridget's grandfather to prison.
Smuggled a bottle of whiskey into the jail where McGee was being held.
That's an amazing story. Yeah.
So let's hear it.
And my father asked him, said, did you or did you not rape Mrs. Hawkins? Were you guilty? And he got his answer. And my father never divulged it to anyone else, and I'm not going to divulge it now.
Yeah, what happens in that tape, and encourage anyone who's interested to go to the podcast and hear the whole story, Bridget starts interrogating him. I mean, it's this lovely scene. She's going to visit the son of the prosecutor that sent her grandfather to prison, and he welcomes her and hugs her, and you know, I was there at the time, too. It's this really kind of beautiful moment, but he also says, I'm not going to tell you what Willie McGee said to my dad on the night of his execution. And she just interrogates him in this beautiful, beautiful way.
It's really well done.
And it's actually one of the my favorite scenes I've ever had the honor to kind of witness and record. Just that she really just beautifully needles him and pressures him and pushes him until finally he asks for the tape recorder to be turned off, and she does, and he tells her the answer.
I'm not going to spoil it. I want people to actually hear it. Yeah. Here's the thing, Joe. As I'm listening to the podcast, it becomes apparent to me that whites in that town in those days couldn't believe or wouldn't allow themselves to imagine a world where a white woman would want sex with a black man. Family members told Willie's granddaughter that they strongly believe the situation was more of an affair.
Willie was married, yeah, and with kids, yeah.
Yeah, that it was an affair and less of a rape. Let's hear from Bridget speaking with her aunt, Willie's sister.
I was told that they had been going together, and then when they finally got caught, they accused them of rape.
Did they say how long they had been dating or going together?
No, I don't know if it was years or what, but back in the South, you know, black men's kung fu with no white women.
What kinds of feedback have you received about this podcast over the years?
You know, I mean, I think we got great feedback, and it won some awards, which was wonderful. And I think partly it was, again, for me, that For me, this was the best example, and I'd love to find another example someday, of this fusion of kind of first-person storytelling and like investigative journalism, even though it's about history. And so I think that people responded to that idea of it kind of hit both those notes of like this Bridget's real personal story and really searching for her family's history. And then also this real important chapter of history that had been largely forgotten. So, I think people responded to this, to being able to do both those things at once, which doesn't happen very often.
Yeah. I want folks to see you tonight, and I do. Joe Richman has been my guest. He is the founder and executive producer of the podcast Radio Diaries. You can hear his radio documentary on Willie McGee at gpbnews.org. Oh, great. So you can find it right here on our website. Joe is in Atlanta for the Radiotopia Live East Coast Tour event. And tell us a bit about the event tonight.
Yeah, thank you for asking. We're here with six different shows that are part of the network Radiotopia. Radiotopia is a podcast network. It's sort of like a collective of all these different shows, some that are kind of public radio shows that are also a podcast, some that are podcast-only programs. And it kind of runs a gamut, all different kinds of shows, Criminal, 99% Invisible, The Memory Palace, The Kitchen Sisters, and a bunch of us are doing this tour up the East Coast starting tonight in Atlanta. We're going to be in a tour bus like rock stars. I can't wait.
And you're at Center Stage Theater.
And it's a real variety of shows, and there's a live band, and I'm doing a piece of live music, so it's fun.
Joe, thanks for being on the program.
Oh, such a pleasure. Thank you.